good night.
Hello, cocktail lovers, and Happy New Year. Welcome to Paris Cocktail Talk, the show brought to you by the 52 Martinis, Guide to Paris Cocktail Bars. I'm Forrest Collins, and I'm here to talk to you about cocktailing in the French capital and bring you other small batch spirits news from France and beyond. And it's the new year. I know that you have all had a really big December, and now you're probably on that dryuary and all kinds of stuff like that. So now that all the fun is over, guess what? I've brought you something really fun to listen to. And I've got my friend here, David Leibovitz, in the studio. I'm sure he doesn't really need much introduction, but he is a cookbook author. He's a pastry chef. Many of you are probably familiar with his blog. I'm going to let him introduce himself as well in case I'm missing anything. Oh. He's written 8 books, the most recent, which is La Part, and one that I was just telling him I think is exceptionally beautiful, which is My Paris Kitchen.
Yes.
Yes. So am I missing anything, David?
No, but I'm so excited to be here because I started listening to podcasts about a year ago. And of course, I started, you know, you were one of the first few I listened to because I know you. And you have this amazing radio voice.
Oh, thank you.
And I was listening to you and I was like, I know this person.
Oh, I hope you didn't listen to the early ones, though, because they're not so good. But the last one was good.
Yeah.
If you guys out there didn't listen to my one with Thierry, it's really good. Go listen. And by the way, also speaking of listening to podcasts, when I came up to the little studio here, David was already here. And guess who he was here with? He was here with Oliver G. And they were recording for the Earful Tower. So I know that one has already come out. So if you don't subscribe to his podcast and you haven't listened to it and you want more David, which I'm sure you will even after this, go pop over to the Earful Tower and give that one a listen. And it's actually the second time you were on the Earful Tower, isn't it?
Right. And that was the prequel to this. However, I saved all the confidential information for you.
Oh, good.
He kept asking
me questions.
Lucky. I'm like, I don't know about that. Let me get back to you.
Oh, good. I feel so special. All right. Okay, good. Well, let's see. Do you want to tell the listeners about what's going on with you lately? If you're working on anything interesting?
Oh, my God. I'm always working on something interesting. Today, yes. I cleaned my refrigerator.
Okay.
I woke up and I had a list. I was like, go to the market, have coffee with my neighbor, finish my book, clean the refrigerator. And I cleaned the refrigerator. That was very exciting. And I have all these syrups in there because I've been making all these cocktails and they're all in the back. You know, things move to the back of the refrigerator. And I was like, wow, I made this pine syrup, you know, with pine needles to make cocktails with. And I have all these things. So I'm looking forward to, you know, in the new year to be able to use them and to make all these new cocktails.
Very exciting. I do that sometimes too. And then sometimes I forget what the syrups are. I need some system of labels. I think, I'll remember because, you know, it's just, but no.
Well, somebody gave me a label maker once for Christmas, and it looks like one of those things that they use in France to take your credit cards with, you know, like those things you bring over to the table.
Yeah.
So I always take it out when people come over and I go, after dinner, I'm like, can I have your credit card? And they're like, what?
I like that. Now I have to get one of those just to do that. But I like that. But like aesthetically, like when I make syrups, they're in the fridge, you get some condensation when you move them in and out. I know this sounds like really like very persnickety, but I'm like, oh, I don't like it when the labels get all mushy. So does your label maker, or like if you just like slap on like paper labels, they kind of like get yucky?
They're amazing.
Okay.
I'm
going to have to check out your label maker.
Well, because I was a pastry chef and a line cook and a restaurant cook, so I'm really good at labels.
Okay.
That's all I did for like 30 years was make labels date things.
We'll have to have a drink later and you can give me some label tips so I don't get my syrups mixed up in my fridge. So
that's sort of what I'm working on. I'm working on, you know, a lot of these syrups, and I'm very interested in what's, you know, France, as you know, there's this culture here of drinks and cocktails, and not just drinks and cocktails, but everything. You know, people are really into drinking. You know, water is like an issue, you know, everything, coffee, there's so much part of the French culture. So that's what I've been exploring lately, and I've been fascinated by it.
Now, here's something that I think is interesting. A lot of people say to me, oh, cocktails are great. You know, lots of people want to talk to me about cocktails. They're just like cooking. I personally don't think cocktails are just like cooking. And that's a longer conversation. But I think there's a lot of differences between drinking cocktails and cooking. However, I do think that maybe there's some similarities, and I'm saying this as a non-baker, between baking and cocktails. Because I think that in both cases, you're worrying maybe more precisely about proportions, right. and you're putting them together to create something that is really something different than, you know, more than the sum of its parts. Right. Well, so what are your thoughts on that?
Well, when you started talking about this, what you just talked about, I was going to cut you off, and then you changed in the middle sentence to what actually I was going to reiterate was that baking and making cocktails are almost the same thing. You're taking disparate ingredients, putting them together to create something different. You know, in a way, a Caesar salad works. You know, you have anchovies, you have, you know, egg, olive oil. And when you eat this dressing, it doesn't taste like all these ingredients. It tastes like something else. So similar, when you, you know, have a Negroni, you've got these three ingredients, and you don't necessarily taste each one individually, but together they form something. And that's why, you know, a lot of people are very, you know, persnickety about, like, what kind of vermouth to use, because they work different. You know, these alcohols work different with each other. It's fascinating.
Yeah.
And so I'm, you know, I'm taking a deep dive into all that stuff. You know, I learned how to become a bartender. And I was having a conversation with somebody who owns a spirits company. And he's been making spirits for over 20 years. And in the middle of the conversation, he stopped. He goes, "You're an expert." I said, "Well, not really." He goes, "You know as much as I do." Just because I love the subject, and I love taking it. I love understanding whatever I'm working on. That's one of the joys of doing a cookbook, is that you learn a lot. You know, you want to make a pain de piece. Well, what makes a, you know, you have to think, well, what makes a good pain de piece? You know, like a Caesar salad. What makes a good, you know, cocktail? It's getting the ingredients just right. A quarter ounce makes a difference. Do I use yellow chartreuse? Do I use green chartreuse? Do I use Suze? Do I use Salers? You know, which are very different, actually. So, as you know, I don't have to tell you anything. You know everything.
But it's really a pleasure for me to be able to talk to somebody who, you know, who's interested in the same subject. Yeah. So
I'm obsessed.
Yeah.
I got obsessed with Picon, aussi.
Yeah, I know. We've talked about that a bit. And
I'm still obsessed with it.
On the hunt for some more information. Anyway, that's a different story.
It doesn't exist. I found out.
Well, I've made some calls. I don't know. Okay. We'll talk about it. But so you learned to be a bartender. Tell me about that. Any surprises? Was it harder than you thought? Easier than you thought? Did you learn any life lessons?
No, but I learned that it's really hard work. And that, actually I was talking to a bartender, in Brooklyn, and I said, well, you know, I always wanted to be a bartender, but I didn't want to be sticky all the time. Like, I don't like having my hands sticky. He goes, well, if you're doing your job right, there shouldn't be anything sticky. I was like, thank you. But that was a very good, you know, way he said that. And, you know, that's what the profession, you know, requires organization. Someone who's sticky, someone who's making a mess, they're not going to be a good bartender.
I think that's what you're going to find in the bars where, you know, which have their place for someone else, but sports bars where people are throwing back shots and, you know, it's a big bunch of fun. But yeah, I think in that sense, you do, a good bartender is like somebody who works well in the kitchen as well. You keep things clean. You keep things organized. I mean,
And that's, you know, one of the things I got back into cocktails was in Paris. You know, I drank a lot of cocktails when I was younger, you know, living in San Francisco. We had great bars. But I was at Mary Celeste when it opened, and Carlos was the bartender, head bartender at the time. He's not just great, he's really great. And he came out from behind the bar and just asked me, what would you like? And it was so professional, but without being patronizing. You know, it was very, that's how a bartender should be, you know, engaged with me. And I get that way, like, even if you go to, like, Red House, which is sort of an American dive bar, you see the way Joe deals with you and the customers, and there's this respect. And you know, it's supposed to, once again, you talk about doing, you know, bars or your shots and stuff, you know, it's kind of, they have pitchers of beer, but it's very organized. You know, he runs a really clean, wonderful bar, and it's fun. You know, it's a lot of fun to go there.
Yeah. Well, like you, I kind of got back into cocktails when I was in Paris, and I mean, there's so much good wine that, you know, it was easy to be sort of sidetracked from cocktails for a while. And
well, the thing is, the thing about drinking wine in France is it's a social custom. It's not just drinking, you know, in America, when it's like, let's have wine. You know, it's like a special event. So it's easier to drink wine here because, you know, it's a little lower in alcohol than it is in the States. It's just sort of more socially, it's just part of the fabric of life.
Yeah.
Whereas cocktails, it's like, okay, now we're going to have cocktails. And it's like, oh, you know, they're very strong, and I don't know if I can have one.
I think that's reflected in the relative prices of them too. I think here, you know, you're going to find, you can find wine, maybe it's plonky, maybe it's decent, for, you know, very accessible prices. whereas cocktails are more. And I know we have bars that are putting them out here at more accessible prices, but relatively, you know, and it's the complete opposite in the States. You know, you're going to get decent wine, you're going to pay $12 for a glass, maybe more. I don't know. I had never ordered wine in the States anymore because
it's so
expensive. I'm not paying that for a glass of wine.
Well, I've asked friends who have restaurants too, because I was like, why do you price wine, a glass of wine, the same as a cocktail? And, you know, I appreciate what winemakers do, and it's not like it's not throwing shade at them. Everyone should make money at what they do. It's just you're having someone stand there at a bar and, you know, use ingredients that cost $30 to $50 a bottle, whatever, to make a drink. It's a lot less labor intensive than somebody opening a bottle of wine and pouring it into a glass. And when, you know, I'm painting a broad stroke here. There are sommeliers, there are people who work in that. But it seems like a glass of wine, if you priced it less, people would drink more. Because I always have like one glass in America. Whereas here, I'll have like seven.
Yeah. Well, I mean, here it's just what goes with a meal. So, you know, I mean, it's a different approach. And I know you can't generalize, you know, different in different places. But but speaking of that, obviously you're here, but you also spend a lot of time in New York. I know you drink a lot of cocktails in New York. What do you think about the differences? Can you talk to me about any differences you notice in the approach there in New York versus in Paris or in styles? I mean, do you get there and think much better in Paris because they do it, you know, et cetera?
Well, I went back to the U.S. for a couple reasons. A lot of times I lost touch with my family. You know, because when you live over here, you start becoming one of those Americans that doesn't know what's going on in America. And then I went there. I was like, oh, okay. but it was also really interesting. I met a lot of people. I have a lot of friends who are cocktail writers. One of them is Brad Parsons, who wrote Amaro and Bitters. And we spent a lot of time together. And I learned a lot from him and from meeting all these people. You know, the differences are very interesting between New York and Paris. I think people are more like curious in America. They want to know, like, what's Calvados? Oh, look at that vermouth. You know, like we were talking about Dolan vermouth recently, which is huge in America.
Right.
It's this wonderful French vermouth. And somebody said, oh, it must be so great to live in France where you can buy those things so easily. It's like, well, actually, you have to kind of hunt them down.
Right. So many times I've had friends, I can't wait to come see you so we can drink Lillet on a terrace.
Yeah,
I'm
nobody's
drinking Lillet on a terrace here, and nobody's got Dolan. And, you know, I'm getting Wally Pratt at the store like everybody else.
Yeah.
And, you know, it takes effort. You know, it's just like, I remember when everybody was drinking Saint Germain and I was going here to specialty shops to buy it, you know, that had been, re-imported from the States and cost crazy amounts. You know, those things are changing.
Well, Dubonnet
but still
is very interesting because it's actually made in America now. there is a French one, but so it is, you know, the American, you know, the craft cocktail movement has brought all these drinks to the forefront, like Sous, like Dubonnet, like beer, B-Y-R-R-H, and so forth. And to me, I was fascinated to see how Americans have adopted these things.
Think maybe they've kind of like grabbed on stronger than most French people I know. I'm not talking about maybe the niche that's really into cocktails here, because that's another subject we can talk about just after, is, you know, all these aperitifs. But I do think I think Americans would be surprised at what the French people are really drinking when they have these romantic ideas of them sipping Lillet on the terrace or, you know, sipping whatever. They're not even drinking Kir Royales. I mean, they're just drinking, you know, wine probably.
Well, I live in the 11th. I mean, everyone drinks beer. No, you know, nobody drinks, you know, a Kir. You wouldn't, you know, it's a younger crowd and they're all into beer. They love, you know, or natural wine has become like a big thing. Although it's interesting because I've been talking to like people in the natural wine business. I was like, these people are all like militant anti-chemical. They're really, you know, natural wines don't really have a definition, but, you know, by default, they don't use chemicals. They don't add additives to the wine and so forth. Yet they all smoke.
Yeah.
I want to figure out.
Well, and also I do have to say, you know, I get not just the natural wine, but people saying, do you have healthy cocktails? Do you have the vegan cocktails?
Oh, yeah.
And I'm going to tell you right now, people, everybody out there, alcohol is poison for your body. Mm-hmm. So I'm not saying you don't ever drink, but you drink responsibly. And And it really, right. it's really not going to be healthy for you. Natural wine is still has an alcohol content. And I know there's studies that talk about wine a little bit being good for your heart, but I agree with you. I find it funny. It is this sort of militant attitude that,
Well, I've been a baker most of my life. And so I hear, I shouldn't eat cookies. I shouldn't eat brownies and whatever, croissants. I eat all those things and you do too. And we all do in France. It's just, we eat a variety of things. I eat a lot of vegetables. When I eat bread, I eat good bread. I eat butter. Yeah. I like butter. I don't eat a bag of potato chips. I eat butter. That's my fat. So
The butter's so good here.
I know. The potato chips are actually good here too.
Yeah, I know. But okay, so potato chips, that kind of like wiggles me a little bit into something else I really like to talk about, which is aperitifs. And now I really love like the whole French range, the things that you were talking about, bière and sous. And yeah, all of these are great.
J'adore Bonal.
So, I've been fascinated. I've done a lot of events. When I was doing a lot of things through the chamber, I was doing the art of the apero, like really trying to introduce people, both expats and French, to the art of the aperitif. Like it's not just let's go have beer and eat a lot of stuff. It's not necessarily an aperitif dinatoire. It is it's an aperitif where you're opening your appetite and.
Well, it's a nice way to drink. You put something in a glass. It doesn't require, a mixology license to put together with an ice cube and a twist.
Yeah. And it's got also like this great tradition. Now, again, I think that I honestly don't know when I go into the shops and I have a lot of people who ask me, I'm going to the States actually soon and Canada. They're both asking me to bring some pecan over. And I wonder like who's buying these things because I never see French people drinking them except when I'm outside of Paris. Now, when I am in Beaujolais with Thibaut's family, sometimes they'll pull some of these things out. But
sous. Everybody's like, when I tell sous people, I love sous. And they actually introduced a new one that's like sous racines. Have you seen that?
I have. Now, sous, I think we might be seeing more sous because I do think sous is making a pretty big marketing push. Yes. I see a lot of, there's a lot of sous events and they had something, this was a few years back, but they were up on the top of the Perchoir, the one that's over in the Oberkampf. And a few years back, they had something like warm sous cocktails at,
One thing about sous and one thing I've learned, with cocktails is things that are stronger work well in cocktails. Like that's why chartreuse is, the best thing you could put in a cocktail because it's stronger in alcohol. When you dilute it, you still have that flavor, which is something French people kind of always, pastis used to be. Absinthe, it was very strong.
All of these things, these gentian-based spirits. And I do feel like now, it's hard to say, but I feel like the younger generation, either they're out drinking beers on a terrace and they're probably drinking lagers, or now I do think with this kind of cocktail revival of cocktails.
The spritz.
Yeah, they're the spritz. But again, now that's a marketing thing, right? Like the spritz, it's just the same reason the mojito's here. So anyway, I just think aperitifs and the traditional French style of aperitifs is awesome. Do you have any favorite aperitifs that you like to do at home?
Well, I'm really into Bonal. It was funny because I've been reading The Auberge of the Flowering Hearth, which is a book that was written, I think, in the 70s or 80s about that region. I went to Chartreuse about a month ago, and I'm just fascinated by that whole, the mystique around the liquor. But there's 1,000 years of history behind, the stuff in the green, the green stuff, the stuff in the green bottle or the green stuff in the bottle. It's both. But actually, Bonal is very interesting too because it was made by a fellow who was an orphan of the monks and then he became their doctor when he grew up. And that was, he would go to the mountain and gather these herbs and make this drink. And in the book, L'Auberge of the Flowering Hearth, the guy who wrote it is this wonderful food writer, but he said something about... He talked about a lot about aperitifs too, and he's like, as an aside, he goes, "Well, it's an acquired taste." And he was like, "Let's leave it at that." But I love it because it's that cankina, the quinine.
Yeah,
it's very botanical. It's funny being a baker and pastry chef. I used to tell people like I don't like sweets, and they were like, "Oh, that's like so funny." I was like, "Well, I love chocolate. I love coffee. I love raspberries. I tend to like things that aren't sugary, so my taste tend toward things like whiskey." And these aperitifs, and that's what That's what I really gravitate toward too. So, you know, once again, you don't have to do that much to them. And I don't care about diluting them. In the book that I'm working on, I've got several aperitifs. It's very interesting to do. Most of them don't work as well when you add too many ingredients.
Yeah. I think they stand alone nicely. And I think primarily they're made to stand alone. I don't think that they were being made at a time, you know, when they were planning on mixing them into things.
It's been interesting learning about them and meeting all the people who produce them. And that's something that I just have loved. Like this weekend, I'm going to Burgundy to meet some of the producers. And I'm just, they're kind of fascinated that I'm fascinated. Because I ask them very good questions too. They're not just regular.
I think people appreciate it when you do take a deep dive into their topic. And I do think, it makes it more enjoyable. Yeah. And the thing I do like about some of these aperitifs, I know we've talked about this before too, is they're a regional matter, right? Mm-hmm. You know, you're going down to Marseille, you're going to be drinking your pastis. And so they're also kind of a way to sort of take a trip around France just at home. So,
well, that was the birth of, you know, pastis became popular because people had taken a trip to Marseille. They had gone on vacation. They came back, you know, they lived in the north of France. Like, oh, we want to live the Provençal life. So it is a way to take a little trip to France. You know, one thing that Americans have adopted, you'd say, Lillet.
Yeah,
we were talking about, like,
definitely.
You know, when you say no one in France.
Oh, it's how they feel like they live their romantic France, you know, vacation.
But it's true. You drink a glass of it and you really feel, it's different. It's not like drinking a glass of wine. There's something fun about it. And there's something, it's a joie de vivre, to sound sort of cliche, that you're having this drink that people would drink on a terrace in Bordeaux.
Absolutely.
And I think that's why, like, Lillet, they did a really good job. And they actually made a specific marketing push in America before it was sort of fashionable to market to Americans. And they did a really good job. And that's, you know, we love Lillet. I love Lillet.
Yeah, it is. And it's just,
I could use a glass right now.
I know.
We're both looking at each other.
Yeah. Well, so I know that on your blog, sometimes you put up some recipes. Do you have any favorite cocktail recipes that you've put up there that you want to talk to the readers about?
So I've got a cocktail that I'm going to put up for Christmas that has beer in it, BYRRH. Because I think, you know, one of the great things about having a blog is that I can introduce my readers to these things that they don't normally know about, and it doesn't cost them anything, and they're very open. You know, it's not like they have to buy a book to learn these things. It's like, it's sort of a win-win situation. Like they get to learn about something, and the company, it's good for the company to, it's like Cap Course. You know,
it's
sort of a lesser known thing, but it's fun talking about it, introducing people to it. So I've been trying to do more cocktails on my blog just because it's going with the theme of my next book and what I'm working on. I'm traveling. I'm going to places like Chartreuse, Dolin, Vermouth, Chambéry, Noilly Prat, and seeing how they make things. And it's fascinating.
Yeah, I'm sure it is very interesting. Okay, so we're in January. Did you have good holidays, by the way?
I did. Okay. You know, often we go away, but I love being in Paris when there's nobody here. Like, August is heaven. That week after Christmas, a lot of tourists come to Paris and they get all freaked out because, like, we're coming for Christmas. Like, where should we eat? Where should we go? Like, everything's closed. What's going to be open? I'm like, okay, take a deep breath. Just walk around the streets.
Yeah.
Have a great time. See a cafe that's open. Go have a croque monsieur and a glass of wine for lunch. You wouldn't do that at home. It's very French.
And also, they decorate the streets really nicely here for the holidays. And you know what? The decorations are probably still up because the French leave their decorations up forever. Yeah. So,
and the galette d'oie.
Yes. So everybody drops off the drinking wagon in January. You know how there's the big dryuary. I don't, but I have done it in February before, but that's because February has less days than January. Mm-hmm. But I think it's better to drink in moderation than to just say, oh, I'm never drinking. But what do you think about the mocktail trend? That is very prevalent. It's very prevalent all over. You know, it goes hand in hand with the low octane cocktail trends and these aperitifs and, you know, things like vermouths and things that are lower in alcohol. But I think that it is very prevalent in France. Mm-hmm. I think that I've seen more and more bars are really developing their non-alcoholic cocktail menus. Actually, nobody likes to call it mocktails, but me. I do think that there's a very valid reason for calling it a mocktail, because I feel like there's different purposes for drinking a cocktail, mm-hmm. Whether it's taste, whether it's to be celebratory, to be convivial, to alter mm-hmm. your mood. And so if this drink is serving those purposes and being made with the same techniques you use to make a cocktail, mm-hmm. then you are making a mock cocktail. It is not a faux cocktail, and I don't mean mocking in like a pejorative way, but you mm-hmm. know, this is, I'm making a cocktail, but it's not an actual cocktail. So that's just my little bit. Everybody calls it a non-alcoholic cocktail, except for me. Mm-hmm. I am in defense of the word mocktail.
So I just want to let you know, Forrest just stood up on a soapbox.
Yes.
You can come down now.
Okay. All right. Bring me down. Talk me down, David. But, what do you think in general about mocktails? Do you enjoy them? Do you think they're worth exploring, or?
You know, I recently had one, and I was at a party for a bartender came from Chicago, and she did a mocktail. Her name is Julia, and I forgot her last name. I'm terribly sorry, because she's a well-respected cocktail bartender. She's known for mocktails as well. And she went with, it had like turmeric in it, and it was very, the thing I don't like, I don't like sweet drinks, mm-hmm. so a lot of times you think mocktails, it's going to have like pineapple juice, it's going to have, you know, sugar syrup or something. They're going to compensate adding. It's like vegetarian food. They used to add like tons of cheese, you know, back in the 70s to make up for the lack of meat. It's like, well, you don't need to do that. So it was a beautifully made. She made these beautiful cocktails that were thin. You know, they weren't thick. They weren't like viscous, and it was delicious. That said, it's probably not something – like when I go out and I want a drink, I want alcohol, I like that flavor. I don't like to get drunk, but I like that – the taste, like rye whiskey. You know, if you took out the alcohol and you just had that rye flavor, it would just taste kind of like smoky water, I think.
Yeah. I think there's more exploration to be done, but I agree. For me, it would be like going out for Thai food and just getting the sweet and sour part, but not getting the spice. Mm-hmm. I think that, it's one of the legs of the cocktail that makes it, that adds to the balance. So
yeah, it's a flavor.
Yeah.
And you don't have to add a lot of it, but
yeah. Yeah. I am exploring it more just, like as I was saying, sort of, theoretically, because I am interested in how you can apply cocktail techniques to things that aren't cocktails, but mm-hmm. yeah, my preference is to have a cocktail when I go out. So, and Thomas is telling us it's time to start wrapping up, even though I could just keep talking forever. Is there anything else that you want to share with our listeners?
No, but I love I do. I love your blog, because there's so much information out there.
Thank you.
I often want to email you and say, Forrest, I'm going to be in the 14th. Like, where should I go? I'm like, why should I write her an email? It's on her site. And I do. I go to your site, and it's a really great resource for Paris bars.
Thank you.
And you keep it up to date, and you have a newsletter, which I just discovered.
I just started it.
Oh,
I know.
Okay.
I was so flattered when I saw that you, when we talked about it, I was like, oh, yay, David's looking at my newsletter.
Yeah, well,
I just started it.
Forrest has a newsletter.
Yeah.
And we used to sort of hate emails. Like, everyone's like, I don't want more email, but now it's a way, and yours is actually useful.
I just try to keep it to 5 of my favorite events in the upcoming week. I don't want to there's some other links in there, but that's what I put in there.
I just subscribe to your newsletter. So everyone, all your listeners should subscribe.
Oh, thank you.
Because it does, you know, once again, it's that question, like, what should I do in Paris? We're coming to Paris. It's like, well, actually, here's 5 insider tips that you wouldn't hear about anywhere else.
Thank you.
So.
Well, thank you very much. As you know, I'm a big fan of yours as well. I feel very honored that you took the time to come down and talk to me. And and hopefully we'll have some time for, I don't know, a cocktail or something soon, and we can talk more about the exciting world of drinks. And for the listeners, seriously, I'm sure that you already know who David is, but if you don't, check out his blog, check out his books. I will be putting links to all of these things in the show notes so you can easily find them and find out about the recipes that he's cooking up for cocktails and lots of other things too. And I think that is pretty much a wrap for this month. As usual, I want to say thanks to Thomas for producing. Don't forget, he has a site, or not a site, a podcast, blah, and it's called Uni Talks. Thanks to Emily Dilling for doing work on the show notes. She also has a podcast which is no longer being produced, but you can still listen to it. It's called Perry Payzan. She also has a book out and a blog herself. Thanks to Sun Little for the music. Thanks to World Radio Paris for production. And usually I have notes in front of me, but I think I've covered everybody I need to thank. I should remind you to drink responsibly. And one last thing, I like doing the podcast. It's super fun, especially when I have people like David on. But if you like what I'm doing too, please hop over to iTunes and leave me a review, because it makes me feel a little bit better when I know that people are actually listening. And I think that's a wrap for now. So until next month, cheers. You're a river, darling, you're a river. You're a star to shiver by.